Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Kate Spade, a designer who turned her love of handbags and accessories into a multinational, multi-billion dollar brand, was found dead today.
That's CBS's Jeff Glor with the report of the famous designer's death by suicide on Tuesday. The news shocked the fashion industry and Spade's many admirers worldwide. But the story goes beyond the designer. Her death is one among a recent spike in the suicide rate for women. What's behind this increase, and what can we do to combat it? This hour on Point, Kate Spade's suicide and women's mental health. What did Kate Spade's designs mean to you? And can this tragedy become a teaching moment, a reckoning moment about the problem of suicide? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Matthew Schneier. He's a styles reporter for the New York Times. He was one of the reporters who wrote the paper's obituary for Kate Spade. You can find a link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Matthew, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
And first, for those of us not so familiar with her, tell us about Kate Spade and her work.
Well, Kate Spade was a designer initially principally of handbags. She got her start in the industry as a fashion and accessories editor in magazines and eventually saw enough bags and enough bags that didn't really speak to her that she thought there was room in the market for something a little bit simpler, a little bit more pared back, a little bit kind of a more fun, youthful sensibility. And in 1993, with her husband and an old friend of theirs, a partner of theirs, they launched Kate Spade. And it was a pretty immediate hit from kind of the get-go. It was a little bit of a lower price point than some of the designer handbags that were coming up at the time. And I think it really connected with sort of women in the beginning of their careers and younger women. You know, as the years went on, it became, in certain circles at least, a kind of status symbol for a kind of younger women starting out.
So she became a brand, and she was quite successful.
She absolutely became a brand. You know, she is one of the people we think of as kind of kicking off this sort of lifestyle brand movement, and I think in that way an inspiration for later designers and brands, people like Tory Burch or what Jenna Lyons was able to do at J. Crew. I mean, she had a really kind of 360 view of what it meant to be Kate Spade, and that kind of... That went from the handbags to eventually the clothes that were launched, mm-hmm. the home goods, paper goods. You kind of saw this sort of fun, slightly 60-ish sort of all-American sensibility touch everything she did. And then it extended to the books that she wrote about style and manners and, you know, special occasions to all of the products. She really kind of created this Kate Spade world. And I think people really wanted to kind of enjoy that and be a part of it.
Yeah, after her new brand, Francis Valentine, was launched in 2016, Kate Spade did an interview on CNBC about her plans to recreate the magic of her namesake company.
The details and the quality are so important that you have to. It has to have an emotional tug. It has to have the, even if it's the simplest shoe, it has to have something that says, oh, I have to have you.
Those are glimpses and the story of the public person, the person so famous her name was a brand. What did we or what do we now know about her mental state, if we can know about such things, and were her problems known about before her death?
Well, we're beginning to know, and you know, as with all cases, I think, of a pretty famous person and a tragic incident like this, there's both information and misinformation out there. But you know, her husband Andy spoke to the paper yesterday and gave indications that she'd been suffering from fairly serious depression from the age of 49 for the past sort of 6 years or so, that she had depression and anxiety issues throughout their long marriage, but it really ramped up for whatever reason in the last several years. That said, he said that there was no indication that he or their daughter had that she was considering suicide or that she was suicidal. And there have been some reports in the press from an older sister of hers who's given some interviews saying that she was not surprised by this development. But at the moment, that viewpoint is yeah. pretty well refuted by her other family members. There's another brother as well
who disputed and said
inaccurate yeah. and said that she was in fact fairly well estranged. So I'm sure we'll be hearing more from that and learning more about that. But she certainly is someone who, behind the kind of facade of Kate Spade and the facade of the brand, was, I think, certainly suffering from some depressive issues.
Suffering from depression and, according to her husband, also being treated for depression. Do I have that right?
I think that's right. I mean, exactly what form that treatment was taking, we don't know exactly. He hasn't gone into too many specifics, I think hoping to kind of grieve privately about this. But yes, as far as I understand from the statements that he's given and the family members that we've spoken to, she was receiving some form of treatment.
Was she still active in business right up until her death?
Yes, as far as we know. I mean, Frances Valentine, the new brand that she launched with her husband Andy, with Elise Ahrens, one of her original partners in Kate Spade, and with another designer who had also worked at Kate Spade for a time, was very much active. You know, the Kate Spade brand itself, the Spades sold, and actually sort of changed hands several times. They sold their shares originally in 1999 to the Neiman Marcus Group. That was later sold to a company then known as Liz Claiborne. The Kate Spade New York brand is now owned by the company that owns Coach. So it's part of a kind of American sort of fashion conglomerate. They were not personally involved with it. But I think you can kind of see Kate's and Andy's real passion for design and for footwear, I think, in particular, accessories and footwear in particular, in that I don't think they particularly needed to work, financially at least, but in 2016, they gave it another try with this new brand that, as far as I'm aware, they were quite committed to.
Matthew Schneier is a styles reporter for the New York Times. Matthew, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me now from New York is Jill Harkavy-Friedman. She's a psychologist and the vice president of research for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Jill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Robert.
And first, is there, in fact, an increase in the rate of suicide? And if so, why?
Well, the rate of suicide has been increasing over the past, since about 1999. And we do see the largest increase for middle-aged women, 44 to about 59. We don't really understand what the contributors to that are. But still, most people do not die by suicide.
When you say most people do not die by suicide, you mean it's a rarity, is what you're saying?
It's very infrequent. Yeah, it's very infrequent, about 13.42 per 100,000 people, which is why when you hear somebody talking about it, you want to take it seriously.
Is there, apart from the one age group that you described, is there clearly a gender gap in the sense of how common suicide is between men and women and who's more likely at what age and what station of life to be suicidal?
Yes, there is a gender difference, but of course suicide affects all genders, all races, all types of people. But men die by suicide, in the most recent number is about almost four times as much as women. But the rate for women has been increasing a little bit more than for men.
When news of Kate Spade's suicide first broke, many people had the reaction that it's a terrible thing for people suffering from clinical depression to not see a therapist, to not see if antidepressants might be helpful. Are you surprised by what Kate Spade's husband has said, that she was in fact seeking some kind of help for her illness and that they were quite aware of her depression and anxiety?
Well, of course, I can't talk about her in particular, but I can say, first of all, that unfortunately, most people who die by suicide aren't in treatment at the time of their death, but some are. But being in treatment and receiving the right treatment, and which is a process of finding the right treatment, so it takes a lot of patience and persistence to get to that point for some people. Some people fare well pretty quickly with therapy and or medication or both. But for some people, it's a long process. The other thing that happens is people believe they're in treatment, but they're actually trying a lot of different things, where they never really give one thing a full trial. But the brain is complicated, and our lives are complicated. So sometimes it can be very hard to find the right treatment, but usually you'll get there eventually.
I wanted to read to you something that listener Corey Jagger wrote on Facebook. She wrote this on the subject. As a veteran with PTSD, I can tell you from years of experience engaging professionals that a woman with a mental health crisis is not taken nearly as seriously as a man. The patronization and minimization is routine. I feel pretty lucky to be alive, and it's in spite of the mental health world. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, everybody has their own experience. And being a veteran, you're already, if you're a female veteran, you're in a minority. And we know that female veterans are, their rate of suicide is increasing as well. I think that suicide is complex. There are so many factors that come together to lead somebody to that point. And we do have interventions and treatments that make a difference. But whether or not you're a woman or a man, sometimes you do have to be persistent to get the right treatment. It's in part because we need to improve awareness about suicide and about mental health, and we need to include education for clinicians about that. Because women die by suicide less frequently, there may be the idea that, oh, she's a woman, she's not going to die, but that's a false belief. Both men and women will, can die by suicide.
I read very briefly, and I don't know the authority for it, an assertion that there is an odd fact that the rate for suicide among women is much lower, but women are more common to think about suicide than men. Does that square with what you know?
Yes. Women are at least more likely to talk about thinking mm-hmm. about it.
I see.
And so men and women are different in how they deal with mental health and how they come forward. And in part, that could be because of the way we as a society, our expectations for men and women, our willingness to talk about mental health.
Let me remind everyone that they can join our conversation. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're talking about women's mental health after the news of designer Kate Spade's death by suicide. You can join the conversation. Are you a woman who has faced mental health challenges? Are some of those challenges particular to women, do you think? Why? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Jill Harkavy Friedman, a psychologist and vice president of research for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Jill, I'd like you to listen with me now to a caller who's on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Susan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks.
Hi.
Am I supposed to?
Yes, go ahead, Susan. Yes.
I'm 59, and I have struggled with chronic depression for almost all of my adult life, and it runs very strongly in my family. I've been suicidal. I've never attempted it. I have a niece who committed suicide, and a first cousin who committed suicide. I've lost three jobs, professional jobs, because it affected my performance and behavior, and I was too embarrassed and ashamed to disclose it because of the stigma. And I'm on medication. I'll probably be on medication for the rest of my life and doing fine. But I obviously, because of all those experiences, I have a lot of very strong and deep reflections about it. One comment that I would have to make, well, two, is one is the stigma. You know, we just have to do something about that. You know, I've had doctors say to me, you know, because of my own shame, you know, we talk about high blood pressure. You just take medication, it takes care of it. You talk about heart condition, the same thing. But as soon as you say any kind of mental health, it's all of a sudden, you know, there's something, you know, wrong with your character or a flaw of some sort. It's not considered a health condition. And then the other thing I would say is I've lived in some pretty rural communities, and your speaker talked about finding the right professional, and that is crucial and really hard.
You may not have as much choice, you're saying, in a rural area.
Well, both ways. Yeah, in a rural area, there are hardly any.
Yeah.
And some don't treat it therapeutically. Some just treat it with medication. And then finding the right doctor is also critical. And so when you don't have a lot of choices, and also when you're in that state of mind trying to find the right fit, it's really challenging.
Susan, let me put your comments to Jill Harkavy Friedman. First of all, do these observations sound familiar to you?
Yes. And Susan, first of all, I'm so glad you're here and talking about this and that you're feeling well. And I think I totally agree with what you've said, because we all have mental health. That's the first thing. We all have physical health. But there was a time when things like having cancer or diabetes were things that people kept a secret. We're in that phase now with mental health, but I do think it's changing. So we all have mental health. Sometimes we feel well, sometimes not so well. Sometimes we have a mental health condition that we have to take care of, as you said, like any other health condition. So the more we talk about it and people come forward the way you are, I think the greater chance that people are going to open up and get the help they need.
Now, let me ask you a question, though, about stigma.
Apart
from a personal sense of embarrassment or shame, do people face a real-world problem of the stigma that might limit their chances for promotion or for being hired in the first place or for being admitted to a program if it's clear that they acknowledge their mental health problem?
I think we're changing in that. I'm not going to say that that doesn't happen. But what we also know is if you're not well, you're not going to get those opportunities anyway, because you're not going to be functioning. And the more people like Susan come forward and say, I have this, I'm dealing with it, and I'm working with it, then there's no reason to put that stigma on it. And there's no reason to hold people back. At the same time, the person has to know what they're capable of and what will help them to maintain their mental health. But this myth that if you don't say anything, you don't take care of it, you're going to be okay is false.
Okay, Susan, thank you for calling. And let's hear now from Anne, who is in Leapers Fork, Tennessee. Hi, you're on the program.
Hi, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
I live with someone who is bipolar, as Kate Spade was. It's not exactly the same as clinical depression, but he's lived with it for years. We're 44 years married tomorrow. And I think that the stigma is something very hard for anyone to deal with. As the expert said, I think the stigma that used to be around cancer is now around mental health. And in some ways, I think bipolar is worse, because you can be extremely functioning, bright, happy, working well one day, and then you can't anymore. And I think that makes it even harder for someone who's high achieving like Kate Spade, and as my husband was, who was an attorney. So, I mean, I think that is part of the problem.
Let me just insert that we're not in a position to have a diagnosis of Kate Spade. There have been things said and written to this effect. We don't know for sure. But Jill Harkavy Friedman, does the problem that Anne is describing for people who do have bipolar disease, does that sound familiar to you?
having any kind of health condition can make things harder. And part of the work is learning how to pace yourself. If there were certain physical limitations you had, you would take that information in and use it. It wouldn't necessarily stop you, but it might alter your path and the way you do what you want to do. So having a health condition of any kind is difficult. It means you have to be vigilant and take care of it. Bipolar disorder in particular, where there are ups and downs, and the ups can be very high and the downs can be very, very low, requires ongoing treatment, and the treatment has its own side effects. But when you're also talking with somebody while taking medication, they can help you figure out how to live with bipolar disorder. So it's a challenge, but it's a challenge worth taking and a challenge that one can achieve.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Orlando, Florida, is Shaina Ali. She's a mental health counselor in private practice. Shaina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Robert. Thank you for having me.
And first, your reaction to news of the death by suicide of Kate Spade.
Well, of course, like many, I was met with shock. However, knowing the common suicidality across the nation and in my own practice, unfortunately, I was not. But I appreciate that it is bringing to light, through the shock, a lot of conversation around potential influences in women, such as perfectionism, work-life balance, and stigma as well that you've been talking about.
Perfectionism. Talk a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So, of course, I do not know Kate Spade, but generally speaking, she is this quintessential image of a woman who is so successful in her field. And that's why many reactions, whether it's fans or celebrities or us here, are shocked to hear a little bit about that. But perfectionism has individuals becoming very self-critical. They can be setting high expectations for themselves, especially if we're thinking about individuals in leadership positions. There's the fear of how am I going to be perceived if I were to have a mental health concern or if I were willing to disclose that I were dealing with mental health care as well.
Jill Harkavy-Friedman, what do we know about you? You mentioned that there's been an increase among women of a certain age. Did you say it was mid to late 40s?
Mid to late 40s to late 50s.
Do we know anything about whether breaking the glass ceiling is an injurious behavior? I mean, do women who are in bigger jobs have more problems? Is there anything to that?
Well, I think that you have to know your own background and your own history, because there are many women who are able to do that and are not at risk for suicide, and therefore it's not a problem for them. You know, suicide is complex. There are many factors that go together, and then often in the face of a current stressor and access to lethal means. So most women who break the glass ceiling, they're not going to be at risk for suicide. It's those health and family and environmental risk factors that raise the level of risk, but still many people with those risk factors are still not going to be thinking or acting on suicidal thoughts. So it's a confluence of many things together. It's not just the glass ceiling, but if you're at risk and you're having significant stress, that could make the difference.
Shaina, in your practice, do you talk with patients who are not high achievers, who have the same problems and who have ordinary workaday lives?
Oh, absolutely. I think Jill makes a wonderful point highlighting how many variables contribute to suicidality, mental health in general. So yes, there could be the glass ceiling as an effect, but there's so many other considerations and stigma. Stigma is so broad. All genders have their different stigmas that are associated. All races, all different types of people are at risk for mental health concerns. It doesn't discriminate, unfortunately.
I'm going to turn now to listener Mary Beth, who is calling from Landrum, South Carolina. Mary Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Robert.
Hi.
I wanted to mention that from my personal experience, my onset of more serious symptoms happened to coincide with perimenopause and menopause. And that's kind of right in that age group that you're talking about. And that really is what brought me to seek medication and to seek serious help, and I went into treatment. So that's something that maybe needs further research, because that's when my hormones and my my experience got very difficult. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks so much for your show.
Jill Harkavy-Friedman, what do you think about that?
Yes, I think, Mary Beth, that you raise a very important point, and that 2 points. One is that menopause can trigger mood disorders for some people who are at risk. And the second is that there are treatments and interventions that can relieve that kind of menopausal depression, anxiety, or other mental health symptoms that emerge during that time. And so that's particularly potent for women who might be at risk, that menopausal shift could make a difference.
Since as you said at the outset, we've seen an increase in the rate of suicide, and it's not just among women. And you mentioned the period from 1999, I guess, until until the present. Have people looked at other? Is there good enough epidemiology or good enough health records to be able to compare with other times or other places? What's happened over the past 20 years? We had one kind of bad recession and then one catastrophe economically. That's one thing that's happened in the past almost 20 years. How do we compare this time with other times to try to understand the increase in suicides?
Well, I think that's a great question. It's also true if you look way back, there were higher rates than there are now. So there are always trends that
Way back when?
Even in the 18, 1900s. Mm-hmm. But now we have something called the National Violent Death Reporting System, which is allowing us to gather data. It's in 40 states right now, and we're hoping that it will be come available in all 50 states, where they actually go back and look at people who died by suicide and other violent deaths. So we don't really have any more information than just the trends. And even if you look at the trends, let's say you look at economy, you know, most 4.8 million people lost their jobs. They didn't die by suicide.
Right.
But if you lose your job and you're at risk, you could lose your health care benefits, so you could lose your treatment, or you could be so stressed that it creates an onset of a mental health condition that you might not otherwise have gotten.
You could also lose the part of your identity that's invested in what you were doing before you lost your job.
Absolutely.
Let's turn now to Marie, who's calling from Garrettsville, Ohio. Marie, you're on point.
Hi, Robert.
Hi.
One of the things I'd like to mention, I have suffered from mental health problems since the early 90s. So quite a long time, been on various medications and counseling and everything else. I don't look at it as a stigma. My hope that the reason why I'm going through this is that somewhere in my life, I could help somebody else. I could understand where they're at and be able to let them know that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I have 3 daughters that, you know, have been on medication and off medication. So I'm able to be there for them. I have also attempted suicide 3 times.
Oh my.
Last time I woke up in an emergency or in the hospital with my father sitting next to me. And I really believe that until you as an individual recognize that you have something going on, and you go and you seek the help, that's the only thing that's going to help. Nobody else can make you do that. I went through that for years, and I thought, you know, I got plan A or plan B. I'm going to be miserable and depressed, or I'm going to do something about it. And I have done something about it, and to this day, I still struggle. And I don't look at it as a stigmatism, and hopefully someday I will be able to help more people, and I have no problem with telling people, yes, I take my happy pills every day.
Okay. Well, Marie, thank you very much, by the way, for talking a bit about that with us. And I wanted to ask Shana Ali, who's a practitioner. I mean, success, would you say? You'd be happy to hear that from a patient?
I am so proud of even hearing Marie call in. I think that takes so much courage to be able to do. And I think it's very courageous to be able to have the ability to go over that threshold and say, I don't believe there's a stigma. Also, when Marie says that she wants to help, I know she's helping a lot of people sharing her story. One person that's brave enough to share, I realized they had a concern. I went to get help. I'm still seeking help and I'm taking control of my life and trying to be happy as well. I believe that isn't tremendously courageous.
It's a comment from a listener on Facebook. Valerie Taylor writes about our discussion. Bravo. Most mental health coverage is relevant to angry men who shoot people. Women feel the good vibes only, please, pressure. We need to be real. Jill Harkavy-Friedman, do you agree with that?
I agree that we need to be talking and having real conversations and putting a face on mental health and understanding suicide. And so thank you, Valerie, for your comment. I'm really glad we're talking here. I do want to add that while 90% of people who die by suicide have a mental health condition, most people who have mental health conditions go on to engage in life and do not die by suicide, just as some of our callers have been saying. So there is a path to well-being and to self-care. And as each of us has a voice at American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we have walks all around the country. They're called Out of the Darkness Walks. And when you walk, you put a face on mental health and suicide prevention, and it helps to break down the negativity that's associated with mental health.
Jill Harkavy-Friedman, stick with us. Shana Ali, mental health counselor in Orlando, Florida, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great.
Thank you.
We're talking about women's mental health and mental health care access after the news of designer Kate Spade's death by suicide. You can join the conversation. Is our mental health care system sufficiently accessible, or are there steps we can take to expand access to those resources? I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're talking about women's mental health and mental health care access after the news of designer Kate Spade's death by suicide. You can join the conversation. Is there a stigma behind seeking treatment for mental illness? Why? What can we do to overcome it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Jill Harkavy-Friedman, a psychologist and vice president of research for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And joining me now from New York is Susan Matthews. She is the science editor at Slate, and you can find a link to her recent piece, Suicide Hotlines Provide a Critical Service, But They Can't Make Up for America's Broken Mental Health Care System. It's at our website, onpointradio.org. Susan Matthews, welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert. Thanks for having me.
And I'd like you first to listen to what a woman named Hannah Martin said about suicidal thoughts that she had for a few years before calling a hotline. Here was her experience when she finally decided to call.
They listened to me. They gave me some suggestions that I hadn't even thought about. And it was just really nice to have someone you don't know, but someone who like cares about you, just kind of listen to you and give you some really good suggestions.
So far, so good. What is lacking in the system that begins with the call to the hotline?
I don't think much is lacking with the hotlines. Actually, as I said in the piece, I volunteer for a suicide hotline and have for 3 years. I think that suicide hotlines are absolutely a fantastic resource, and I was actually really heartened to see in the wake of the Kate Spade news, so many people, including news organizations, being willing to share resources to and phone numbers for people who might be struggling with these thoughts and who might need this resource, which, again, I think is totally essential. The point of my piece is that I think that suicide hotlines and this kind of help that can happen in the moment is one part of the equation. The second part of the equation is having a robust and accessible mental health care system for people to get routine treatment so that they have more of an ability to manage and to take control of their symptoms and to get the help that they need in the long term. And I think that right now in the United States, the system is really opaque. It's hard to navigate. It's particularly difficult for people when they're trying to access that system, when they're probably at one of their lowest moments, and that makes it a bit difficult to break into and to find the right treatment and the right plan for you to manage that those kinds of problems.
I want to ask Jill Harkavy-Friedman of a fair appraisal of what of the system that awaits the person who gets good guidance from the hotline?
Yes, I think I totally agree with Susan that we have some really good services, but being able to get to them and navigate the system can be quite difficult. So even if you have clinicians sitting there who are able to provide solid care, it's long waiting lines and lots of phone calls. And as Susan said, at a time when you're really feeling at your worst.
Susan, if you could wave your magic wand and fix something that would make it better and less opaque and less hard to deal with, what would you do? What would be the change?
Yeah, I volunteer for a crisis hotline, and so a lot of the time I'm helping people make the plan for like what they're going to do the next day when they call mm-hmm. their doctor or when they make the entry point. I think one thing that's a real problem is that sometimes people don't even know where to start. We don't really have a general intake for mental health in the same way that if you're having a physical health problem, you'll go to your general practitioner and say, hey, doc, like this is what's going on, and can I get a referral to a specialist? I think that figuring out some sort of concierge of an intake system to get people acquainted and set up with the right resources that they need for whatever they might be dealing with. Even in this show, we've talked about how some of the issues can be hormonal or some are really just mental health issues, and figuring out how to access and find the right treatment plan and the right doctors who can help you with that can be really difficult. So I think that's a major part of it.
What happens if that person shows up at the emergency room? Jill Harkavy-Friedman, is that? I know we want to discourage people from going to the emergency room, but if you're feeling suicidal, it's an emergency. What would happen?
Yeah, actually, I would say that what happens in emergency rooms is evolving, because we know what's happening doesn't necessarily work. Not everybody who is thinking of suicide, for instance, needs to be hospitalized, but there's a fear that if you tell people, you will end up being hospitalized. Integrated care will ultimately be a way to go. It's happening in primary care, and maybe will happen in emergency departments as well. Emergency departments don't always have mental health clinicians. That's part of the difficulty. When they do, so what happens is, if somebody comes in, there's no mental health clinician, and they end up sitting there for hours or days. And there are interventions and things that we could do in emergency rooms that could help people to manage their mental health, their suicidal ideation and behavior, so they have other avenues to take care. Emergency departments are a good place to go if you're in danger of acting on it, and they will help you. But we still have the problem of accessing mental health care afterwards.
Susan Matthews, do you find that the news of the suicide of a famous person, do you think it stimulates any positive conversation that leads to anything better happening?
I think it can be a combination. I mean, I think that on the one hand, the fear is that it's a bit triggering. On the other hand, I do think like we're having this conversation now, and I think that it is meaningful and tragic, of course, to see, you know, if somebody like Kate Spade, who was so successful, can experience these things, maybe it's not so strange and abnormal that I'm experiencing these things. So I think that the thing that we should try to do in the wake of an event like this is to say, you know, it's not your fault if this is something that you're experiencing. You can reach out and you can get help. And like I said, I think, again, it's really important for people to have access to the hotlines and the emergency touch points to get into the system. It's really on the rest of us and on mental health care professionals and on larger systemic changes to make sure that the rest of the system is functioning well enough so that when people are able to make that first point of contact, they're getting the effective, correct care that they need in the long term afterwards.
Well, Susan Matthews of Slate, thanks so much for talking with us about it today.
And
you bet. I'd like to turn to Jill Harkavy-Friedman and ask you about a question before the call to the hotline. That is, if we know somebody who is, you know, quite distraught about something at home, at work, or we don't know what it is, what's a bright line which would lead you to say that it's a reasonable concern of people that their friend or their family member is potentially suicidal, as opposed to really upset and grieving over something?
Well, I think anytime you're concerned about someone, it's really important and helpful to reach out so it doesn't get to a crisis point. But if you are worried about somebody, there's a lot of hope out there, and there are it's just about starting a conversation. Hey, I noticed that you've been late more than usual, or I noticed that you said you're not sleeping and you look tired. What's going on? Can I help? Do you want to talk? And then just listen. No judgment. You don't have to solve the problem for them. You don't have to become their therapist. Just listen. And then together, if something is going on, you can help them find the help that they need. And having that person to help you makes a big difference because the system is difficult to navigate.
Let's listen to another caller. Mary is calling from Safety Harbor, Florida. Do I have that right, Mary?
That's correct, Robert. Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Wanted to call attention to something I think is missing in this discussion about women's mental health. I'm a 71-year-old woman. At 27, I attempted suicide for the first time ever in my life and the last time. And I did it because of child sexual trauma. At the time, I had never talked about it. It hadn't surfaced. And I had just built up a lot of anxiety and trauma about it. I dealt with it, fortunately, I clearly didn't die, and had help with it and integrated it into my life, had counseling, and went on. I'm not a depressive person. I've never been on medication. I don't have any other mental health problems. I've never had any other attempts at suicide, and I've actually gone on to work with people who have this. But I think the research shows that people who are sexually abused, have sexual assault, are more likely to have suicidal ideation as well as to attempt suicide and to commit suicide. And I think this is something really important to consider as we discuss this.
Jill Harkavy-Friedman, thoughts on that?
Yes, Mary, thank you for bringing that up, because sexual trauma is a potential risk factor, but it's also something I'm so glad that you're talking about, how you found a way to, as you said, integrate it into your life and move forward, which is also possible. It's another thing that there's misunderstanding about and there's stigma about, and talking about it can make a life-altering, have a positive life-altering impact. So it definitely can increase your risk for suicide, but again, you found a way to not only overcome it, but to make it part of your life's work. So thank you for that.
And Brenda is calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on point.
Hi, Robert. I wanted to make the point that many people cannot access mental health care because of the cost. I suffer recurring bouts of intense depression, but I can't go for help because my copay under the insurance is too high for more than one visit.
Does that sound right to you? I mean, not good, but does it sound accurate to you, Jill Harkavy-Friedman?
Well, the cost of any kind of health care is high, but should hopefully not be a reason not to take care of yourself. Because of the Community Mental Health Act, you should have access to care at any cost without reason. So I would check in with your local hospital. You may have done this already, and they should have a list of local resources. The other thing is distance that you raise. You didn't raise it, but it was raised before. And we're starting to have telemedicine as an option for people who live in rural areas or out-of-the-way areas. But check in with your local community mental health center. There should be a place where you can access a sliding treatment with a sliding scale. So I hope that you're able to find that. Also, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has a locator service. You can look at that online to see if you can find a local resource.
I want to read something that a listener, a comment that our listener placed on our website, because we began this whole discussion with the death of Kate Spade and the news of that. And the listener, who signs as Jane Don't, wrote this. That's a long comment, but I think it's worth hearing. I was sad to see the news about Ms. Spade. She was a great and talented woman, and frankly, this surprised me a great deal. When Alexander McQueen hanged himself, I could kind of see that happening because his work was so much darker. But Kate Spade, never in a million years. She had a sense of humor, whimsy, and made high-end fashion affordable. I never owned any of her handbags, but when she became big in the late 90s, tacky logos were all the rage, and her minimalism and understated style were a breath of fresh air. I was only in middle school, approaching high school, but I thought she was awesome then and seemed very down to earth in interviews that I read and saw featuring her. I hope her family is doing the best they can and seek help if they feel they need it. Jill Harkavy Friedman, what about that? The families of someone who has taken his or her own life must be a tremendous sense of guilt that people feel at that moment.
People feel all kinds of things when they lose someone to suicide. And I just want to say that I appreciate Jane Don't's comment that she is appreciating how she lived mm-hmm. rather than the way that Kate Spade died, which we're seeing more and more as well. Suicide takes a toll on families, and everybody in the family is different with regard to how they deal with it. But we know that over 50% of people have been exposed to or affected by suicide. So families are not alone. What they're thinking and feeling, probably many other people are thinking and feeling. And at American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, we have the Survivor Outreach Program, where we actually hook people up with somebody who's experienced a similar loss, but they're a few years out from their loss. Please don't grieve alone. Some people may pull away because they don't understand suicide. People sometimes feel guilt. Sometimes they feel anger. They feel loss. They feel sadness. They feel relief. And they may feel all of those things in a very short period of time. There's no right way to feel about suicide. In the end, the person who died by suicide was the one who did it. And there's nothing you could have done to make them suicidal or to, you know, we can prevent some suicides. Maybe we can't prevent all of them, but we're not going to give up trying. And please, mm-hmm. families who are affected by suicide, reach out. There are support groups. We have our walks are peopled by people who lost someone to suicide. You're not alone. Talk about it. Share it. Get some hugs, give some hugs, and it's a process of recovery.
Jill Harkavy Friedman, a psychologist and vice president of research for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Jill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Kotsinas, Allison Poley, Catherine Proctor, Jeremy Relosa, James Ross, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, all with help from Carolyn Anders. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Coming up, Trump's absolute right to pardon, Super Bowl champs, disinvited justices side with Colorado Baker, the weekly news roundtable dives in tomorrow. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is On Point.